morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, February 27th, 1922, the United States Supreme Court unanimously declared the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, women's right to vote, constitutional, following ratification by the states. The 19th Amendment was passed by Congress 100 years ago, on June 4th, 1919. After a 70-year effort that involved multitudes of meetings, petitions, and protests by women suffragists and their supporters. Tomorrow, February 29th, 1968, Leap Year Day, the Kerner Commission, appointed by President Lyndon Johnson to investigate civil disorder, blamed the racial riots of the 1960s on white racism, and warned of further mob violence and destruction unless immediate and drastic remedies were not taken to prevent growing polarization and discrimination. Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal, the commission warned. Today, February 28th, is the last day of Black History Month. Tomorrow, March 1st, is the first day of Women's History Month. Today is also the last day of Oregon's 160th birthday month, which provides the glue to link the two history months with the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in Oregon and much of the rest of the USA a century ago in the 1920s. Because of Oregon's exclusion decree in its constitution against blacks residing in the state, which was not rectified until 1959, a century after Oregon statehood, there were few blacks for the KKK to oppress. So the bedsheet barbarians turned their attention to Catholics, Jews, immigrants, and other so-called aliens, as well as anybody the local clavern suspected to be un-American in thought or demeanor. And women who defied or were in other ways problematic to sexist right-wing male supremacy were favored targets of Klan wrath. Helen Hill wrote just about such an example of KKK male terrorism and obfuscation in Tillamook, A Brief History of Fear and Intolerance in Tillamook County, which I have excerpted for today's program. Helen Hill is an artist, poet, and playwright who lives in Manzanita. She wrote the following, which she titled for the North Coast Times-Eagle, "You've Been Wanting a Cross, Now We'll Give You a Damned Fiery One," in 2003. Imagine a beautiful young woman in a small, isolated coastal town whose husband is mysteriously ill in a Catholic hospital 100 miles away. She is branded one stormy winter midnight by mysterious men wearing white robes and hoods. She attempts to level a lawsuit against the officials of the small town for allowing outrageous acts against a citizen, but is buried at the grand jury hearing and disappears from history. During this time, the same time, an IWW, International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, labor organizer, is hunted down and jailed on charges of inciting anarchy as one of the last descendants of a legendary tribal chief is hauled to jail for having a pint of whiskey in his back pocket. Illegal moonshine, rumors of loose women, concealed weapons, a crooked police chief, all this in a small town where the local newspaper editor accuses the big city papers of mental orgies when they dare to report the mysterious events happening on the other side of the Coast Range. A Hollywood movie? No. This is 1923 Tillamook County. It is difficult to assess the amount, if any, or degree of terrorizing of the citizens of Tillamook carried out by the Ku Klux Klan, since neither the Klan-controlled Headlight, that's the newspaper, nor the Head in the Sand Herald, another newspaper which conjoined many, many years later into today's Headlight Herald, were likely to report these incidents. There are no records of any personal accounts on file. Not surprising, since the county clerk, the police chief, and the sheriff were Klansmen during the years in question. Certainly, there were outrages committed by the Klan in both rural and urban areas in other parts of the state and the country at this time. In Medford, a band of hooded night riders was terrorizing the town with exercises of 100% Americanism, quote-unquote. On several occasions, they would kidnap undesirables and drive them to a remote area, fit them with a hangman's noose just long enough so that their feet would barely scrape the ground, and hang them for a few minutes, let them down, and string them up again until they got the desired confession or sum of money or whatever they were after. The burning cross, symbol of the Klan's reign, was a frequent sight on Skinner's Butte overlooking Eugene. The only chance for the reporting of a Klan act against a citizen in Tillamook County was if the information was leaked to Portland and came to the attention of the Oregonian or the Portland Telegram or the Oregon Journal, all newspapers not controlled by the Klan. One such incident of a Klan attack on a Tillamook Countian did indeed leak to the Portland papers in January of 1923, and because it came to be so thoroughly discussed in the Portland papers and even sent across the National Associated Press wires, the headlight was reluctantly forced to address the incident. As the only actual record case of a physical assault by the Klan in Tillamook County, the story bears exploring in some detail, especially as it becomes more revealing as more details are known. It is fascinating to compare this report of the branding by the Klan-backed Tillamook headlight with the investigation by the Portland Oregonian and Telegram and the Associated Press, which were considered to be objective news sources during the Klan years. Incidentally, the headlight's rival paper and Herald, which seemed to be solidly committed to safely riding the fence during the Klan years, did not attempt even the smallest mention of this sensational local case. In years to come, a compilation of exactly such outrages would gradually bring about the demise of the Klan as denials grew less and less convincing. The story is fascinating in its blatant contradictions. To begin with, if Mrs. Standish had wanted to stage a branding in order to discredit the Klan, as the headlight claimed, why did she remain silent and wait nearly 2 months to speak about the incident? The scar was, as the Portland papers reported, almost healed over by that time. There were other stories of Klan brandings throughout the state and the country at this time, and why then would Mrs. Standish not come forward and accomplish her end in November when the brand was fresh? Obviously, she was intimidated and afraid of further assault. The fact she was later arrested by the Klan-controlled Tillamook police for carrying a concealed weapon following the branding is also interesting. It seems reasonable to assume she was afraid of additional assaults. The Portland papers reported that her father had given her the gun and told her to keep it on her at all times and to use it if she was assaulted again. How and why did the Tillamook police arrest her for carrying a concealed weapon? The circumstances under which she had been stopped and searched are not told. It doesn't seem far-fetched to assume that whatever anti-Klan activities she had taken on, which prompted them to brand her in order to silence her, she had been silenced. But it seems she was still being watched closely. Webster Holmes, the attorney representing Mrs. Standish, stated in the Oregonian he knew of another branding that had taken place in Bay City. The Oregonian journalist interviewed the city recorder of Bay City, who knew nothing of the branding there, as it had not been reported. Evidently, Nevada's husband, A.M. Standish, was the one who originally broke the story to the police and the Portland papers. In an interview, he related that he was curious as to why his wife was wearing an awkward, and that's a quote, high lace collar when she came to visit him at Portland's anti-Klan St. Vincent's Hospital, rather than the fashionably lower-cut shirtwaist she usually preferred. She reluctantly revealed the brand to him, stating she had not wanted to worry him. In the story of the Standish branding that appeared on page 1 of the January 14, 1923 Sunday Portland Journal, Nevada spoke at length about the assault. She described how two hooded men in Ku Klux Klan robes entered through her door around midnight. She said there were many more Klansmen outside, though she could not say how many. She told reporters that while one man held her down on the bed with his hand over her mouth, the other heated an iron in the wood stove. One of the men asked the other whether they should brand her on the face, and he answered, "No, let's put it on her breast. Then she won't wear any more low-neck dresses." She said she fainted from the pain. She remembered that before the brand seared her flesh, one of them said, "You've been wanting a cross. Now we're going to give you a damned fiery one." The Portland Telegram, which had also covered the story in great detail, illuminated the meaning behind this ominous statement made by Nevada Standish's attacker. According to the Telegram, her husband revealed in an interview from his hospital bed, he had been seriously ill for 16 months, that Nevada, who had moved off their ranch into town to support herself by working for the editor of a more middle-of-the-road Herald newspaper, when Mr. Standish became ill, was, quote, "lonely in Tillamook, and because so many of the women were members of the Ladies of the Invisible Empire, she wanted to join the organization for the sake of the social life it might give her while I was away." The Ladies of the Invisible Empire was the women's arm of the Ku Klux Klan. Evidently, she was turned down because, as her husband, barely able to sit up in bed, continued, "Unless you have a relative who is a member of the Ku Klux Klan, you cannot become a member of the Ladies of the Invisible Empire, and I am not a Klansman. But the man who branded my wife knew of the fact that she had applied for membership in the women's organization, and that's what his remark about wanting a cross meant. If he was not a Klansman, he could not have known that my wife had ever made application for membership in the Ladies of the Invisible Empire." Mr. Standish also referred to what he called the Klan's further effort to damage Mrs. Standish with the dragging up in connection with this affair of the Moonshine case in October. A still had been found on the Standish ranch outside of Tillamook, but they were acquitted on appeal of the charge of having anything to do with the still. Standish maintained, quote, "The moonshine charge couldn't have been any motive for Klansmen branding her, for dozens of the Klansmen around Tillamook are moonshining and bootlegging themselves and couldn't get into a moral frenzy over it, even if they had believed she was connected with any moonshine affair, which they knew she was not," unquote. And remember, this was during Prohibition. Standish laid the blame for the branding at the feet of the Klan, who he believed were reacting to jealous small-town gossip of the sort that comes up around a woman who is left alone and defenseless, Mr. Standish said. Nevada Standish was described as one of the best-looking women in Tillamook, both by her husband and by several other articles. On the lead paragraph on the front page of the Portland Telegram, Mr. Standish threw down the gauntlet to the Klan when he proclaimed, "If Ku Klux Klansmen were not guilty of breaking into my home and branding my wife, then let the Klan bring in the men who did it, and I may be convinced." Mrs. Standish and her attorney, Webster Holmes, evidently pushed to have the alleged crime brought before the grand jury. The jury met to hear the case on February 5, 1923. According to a front-page article in the Headlight, Mrs. Standish was examined by a doctor who testified at the meeting that the brand was a self-inflicted iodine burn. Iodine, in its full strength, is extremely caustic and can cause severe and painful burns. It bears noting that the doctor who examined her, however, was a grand exalted cyclops of the KKK order. The district attorney presiding at the grand jury hearing, Mr. T.H. Goyne, was also a Klansman with a high ranking. The grand jury handed down a no true bill. The Headlight reported that this virtually means that the grand jury believes that the branding did not take place. The authorities ultimately claimed on the basis of the doctor's pronouncement that Mrs. Standish had simulated a Klan brand in an attempt to discredit the KKK and turn public sentiment against them. A few days later, after a private meeting with the Grand Dragon of the Realm of Oregon, Frank Gifford, Nevada Standish publicly and completely refuted that the branding had been done by the Ku Klux Klan. What went on behind those closed doors is forever lost to history. A clue to the branding mystery surfaced 45 years later when Colonel R. Eberhard, former state legislator and Masonic lodge master from La Grande, was killed by a car while crossing a street on an icy night in 1968. When his safe was unlocked by attorneys seeking to settle his estate, it was found to contain over 200 pages of the secret minutes of the La Grande Ku Klux Klan from 1922 to 1924, a very rare and valuable historical find. These minutes were edited and published by David Horowitz, a professor of history at Portland State University. And these were, as David published, "The Klansman is Outsider, Ethnocultural Solidarity and Anti-Elitism in the Oregon Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s," by David A. Horowitz, Pacific Northwest Quarterly, January 1989. Also by Horowitz, "Making Sense of the Oregon Klan in the 1920s," North Coast Times Eagle, June-July, 1995. On January 26, 1923, the minutes report a visit to the La Grande Klan by the Grand Dragon of the Realm, Gifford. After the opening ceremony attended by 72 Klansmen, Gifford spoke to the group on several subjects, including the branding in Tillamook, which by this time was circulating around the country, threatening to further discredit the Klan. Relative to the case in Tillamook, Oregon, Mr. Gifford had this lady come to his office and give an explanation of these alleged accusations, the minutes read, and quote Gifford, "On her left breast you could see a large red spot, and by drawing the skin tight you could trace a very dim cross, probably put on by a very light acid and is rapidly disappearing. This woman held the position of a bootlegger and had trouble with the authorities to the extent that they desired to get rid of her, and this is the means they used. Klansmen, the chief of police, and his assistant put on the cross, and though the papers refused to publish this, our Klan paper, the Western Americans, will eventually do so. We want the whole world to know they can't put this over on the Klan." A brief check of the Tillamook County Klan Cavern 8 membership list for 1923-1924 on file at the Special Collections Library at the University of Oregon in Eugene reveals that the police chief of Tillamook at that time, Henry White, was a dues-paying member of the Tillamook Klan. The Klan paper, the Western American, never published a word about the branding of Nevada's Standish as the La Grande minutes promised. Presumably, the grand jury hearing took place soon after Gifford's visit to La Grande, and with a no true bill handed down, there was no need to refute the story. There is no appeal possible for grand jury decisions. 7 men voted that the crime never occurred. Tillamook did not allow women on the jury, even though a law had been passed in Oregon the year before, requiring women to join the jury pool. Whatever really happened, Nevada Standish ran out of options after the grand jury decision. She disappears from Tillamook history at this point, but the attorney who helped bring her case to the grand jury for a hearing, Webster Holmes, died a few months later. How he died is not known. According to the Tillamook County Court records on file in the State Archives building in Salem, Holmes consistently defended numerous people the Klan would have targeted, including immigrants, foreigners, IWW organizers, and the few Native Americans left in the county. The same grand jury hearing of February 5, 1923, also handed down a true bill indictment against O. Hendricks, an IWW organizer charged with criminal syndicalism for passing out union literature in the area lumber mills. Also indicted that day was Edward Kilkus Marshall, grandson of Chief Kilkus, for alcohol possession. As a result of this indictment, Marshall was later sentenced to 6 months in jail and a $500 fine. astronomical in those days for carrying a pint of whiskey. When the O. Hendricks case was brought to trial, it attracted statewide attention and became a high-profile case for the rights of wobbly organizers across the state. According to frequent articles in the headlight, the Klan continued its steady gain in popularity and influence over the next few months. The paper proudly reported the consolidation of the Wheeler and Tillamook chapters, creating one of the biggest organizations in the county. Members of the famous Klan claimed to have, quote, something less than 1,000, unquote, in membership throughout Tillamook County, a whopping 25% of resident adults. However, the Klan probably inflated estimates of their numbers to appear stronger and more popular than they were. In reality, Klan membership was probably very less than 1,000. On May 30, 1924, one of the largest Klan rallies in the state was held in Tillamook. The headlight proudly reported the grand event as quite orderly and peaceful. Following this large rally, complete with a fiery cross that failed to light, and crash landing of a plane that carried the unit cross, regular accounts of the Klan disappear from Tillamook newspapers. In Tillamook County, as well as elsewhere in the state, the Klan's influence was being rapidly undermined by reporters from larger cities and the dawning realization on the part of communities of what the Klan really stood for. Nationwide, a growing wave of Klansmen were being convicted of more and more lurid crimes involving bootlegging, prostitution, murder, and profiteering, the very crimes they professed to be safeguarding in places like Tillamook County. Perhaps more importantly, the citizens of Tillamook County had realized that far from offering constructive solutions to their lives, the presence of the Klan created negative disruptions, tensions, and a needlessly hostile environment. And that has been from Helen Hills, A Brief History of Fear and Intolerance in Tillamook County. She also wrote a play in 2003 about the branding of Nevada Smith, which was performed by her theater group, Clutchy Theater, in various Oregon cities. The play was titled Time Out of Mind. Helen Hill purchased in 1987 the building she donated to KMUN Coast Community Radio, which after a thorough conversion by volunteers, yet retains its late 19th century Astoria architectural integrity. And she is the inspiration and citizens' initiative provocateur of the Oregon Open Adoption Law that permits adoptees to learn their biological origins and to obtain their birth certificates, the first such law in the United States. Everyone has the right to know who they are, she said, as the purpose of her campaign. And now, as epilogue, something I wrote. Now we are presented with the irresistible question of the perishable moment. What will Donald Trump do to connive a Nobel Peace Prize for his narcissistic self? And what will he do if he is stymied and fails to add a Nobel to his besmirched and fraudulently fabricated profile? Blow up the world, perhaps? Whenever I think of Trump and his North Korean doppelganger, Kim Jong-un, I apply the sobriquets of Fat Man and Little Boy, the names of the first two atomic bombs, especially at such times as now when they mutually play finger-tingly with their nuclear buttons in Hanoi, Vietnam, site of lost American dreams. The widening gulf between centuries and millennia is not the fault of Presidents Obama and Bush, but of Trump and the eerily grotesque distortion of history and current reality, his reign of hallucinatory fabulism, which has a crippling effect on our collective psyche, shoving it into a black hole. The purpose of this universal pathology is corrupt and tawdry, to undo constitutional democracy and supplant it with a personal despotism. All eyes seem to be on Hanoi this moment. My friends and I never got to Hanoi a generation ago when we were grunt marines in the paddies, jungles, and rural villages just south of the DMZ, the invisible border between the fictional sovereignties of South and North Vietnam. In our ascribed war against the North, we committed our massacres and atrocities upon the inhabitants of the South, search and destroying for the political purposes of pacification. Although the single personal goal of every one of us was to survive with our bodies intact. Of course, an intense air war was fought over Hanoi, and quite a few American flyers were shot down and became guests of the infamous Hanoi Hilton, one of the POWs being Trump's arch nemesis, John McCain. Perhaps Trump, known to most of the world as a draft-dodging bully who evaded Vietnam, might despoil McCain's palate at the Hanoi Hilton, as he is reputed to have engineered on the Moscow hotel bed of his other main nemesis, Obama. I think I would have rejected soldiering in Vietnam if I had earlier participated in the civil rights movement, as had many idealistic white women and men who joined black activists in very dangerous civil disobedience, voter registration, and freedom rides in the American South. It took Vietnam to wake me up to the murderously unjust virulence of racism. Spike Lee, who finally got an Oscar this year for his film Black KK Klansman, eloquently defined the significance and meaning of Black History Month on Oscar night this past Sunday. The word is irony. The date, the 24th, the month, February, which also happens to be the shortest month of the year, which also happens to be Black History Month. The year 2019, the year 1619, history, her story, 1619, 400 years. 400 years our ancestors were stolen from Mother Africa and brought to Jamestown, Virginia, enslaved. Our ancestors worked the land from can't see in the morning to can't see at night. My grandmother, Zimmy Shelton Retha, who lived to be 100 years young, who was a Spelman College graduate even though her mother was a slave. My grandmother, who saved 50 years of Social Security checks to put her first grandchild, she called me Spiky Poo, put me through Morehouse College, an NYU grad film, New York University. Before the world tonight, I give praise to our ancestors who have built this country into what it is today with the genocide of its native people. We all connect with our ancestors. We will have love and wisdom regained. We will regain our humanity. It will be a powerful moment. The 2020 presidential election is around the corner. Let's all be on the right side of history. Make the moral choice between love versus hate. Let's do the right thing. You know I had to get that in there. And that was Spike Lee. And of course, Trump denounced Spike Lee's speech as a racist hit on your, parentheses, favorite president. This is Michael McCusker. Happy Women's History Month, beginning tomorrow.